You are listening to
TalkLine Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
Jay Buxbaum here on behalf of MASC. And MASC has been around for nearly 25 years, addressing the needs of the community in addiction and other challenges that families face throughout the metropolitan and even across the world. And you'd wonder why Jay Buxbaum from Kedem would be promoting MASC. And I'll tell you why, because we're very sensitive here that this is a problem that needs to be addressed, and that drinking responsibly is how you have to do it, if at all. So Jay Buxbaum here telling you that MASC's been around for 25 years almost, addressing 113,000 families over those 25 years. Please, now is the time to donate at maskparents.org. That's maskparents with an S, .org. And if you need help, they are the most wonderful resource to go to, point you in the right direction. Call MASC at 718-758-0400. And don't forget to tune in to the MASC show every Thursday night on Zev Brenner's WSNR 620 AM. This is Jay Buxbaum on behalf of MASC, that's right, urging you to please donate today to maskparents.org.
Good evening and welcome back to MASC's weekly radio show on Family Matters. MASC mothers and fathers aligned, saving kids of all ages and all stages for all mental health struggles, including addictions. If you know somebody that needs a referral for a therapist, an inpatient or outpatient program, please give us a call at 718-758-0400. I'll repeat the number. You may want to jot it down for yourself, a loved one, a neighbor, or someone you usually would sit next to in shul. All calls are kept strictly confidential. You may want to join a parent Zoom support group. Give us a call again at 718-758-0400. Tonight, I'm really grateful that we have on with us a frequent visitor on our radio show, and that is Dr. Chaya Leiba Kobernick, who's a clinical psychologist and founder and director of the CBT-DBT Center, which is a group therapy practice specializing in evidence-based mental health care for the from community. I'd like to welcome you on tonight. I know you're so busy, overwhelmed with what's going on in the world and people reaching out to you in so many different areas, from so many different areas. Thank you for making the time, Dr. Kobernick. How are you?
Thank God. Glad to be here.
Glad you're able to be on as well. So, Dr. Kobernick, I really want to discuss, we just got out of COVID not long ago, and so many people that were struggling with simple underlying anxiety blew into bigger anxiety issues and OCD, and in many different ways it manifested itself. But now there is a war in the world going on. And again, people have been calling, phones are ringing off the hook, people struggling with anxiety. And I want to talk about what is DBT and what is CBT so that people could understand how those modalities can be helpful for some.
Sure. So I like to think of CBT as an umbrella term. It stands for cognitive behavioral therapy, and it refers to lots of different types of treatments that focus on how we behave and how we think in order to impact how we feel. So there's lots of different types of CBTs. DBT is one type of CBT. And should I go more into what DBT
is at
this point?
Yes, please.
Okay. So DBT, I could talk about DBT for a very long time as an introduction, but I'll try to keep it for appropriate for here. So DBT is a type of CBT. So it focuses on how we think and how we act to impact how we feel. And it was originally designed for people struggling with big emotions or with their emotions being out of control, or what we call emotion dysregulation. So it can be helpful with several different types of issues, but the core problem for people who benefit from DBT is emotion dysregulation. So experiencing my emotions as out of control or unmanageable. And DBT is a complex treatment. I think DBT is well known for its skills, and that's because it does a great job of presenting and packaging skills in a way that's really user-friendly and really gets a lot in there. And DBT is really a complex treatment model. You can't just, you know, pick up a book and start doing it. There's individual therapy, which is a particular type of style for doing individual therapy. There's group where you learn the skills, which is kind of like a class. So it's not like doing therapy with other people. It's more like a class where you learn the skills. Then there's phone coaching, where your therapist is there for you in the moments when you need help, so that you can learn how to apply the stuff that you're learning in group and in individual into the actual moments. Sometimes family is included, definitely, you know, parents, sometimes even siblings, depending on the person and what the need is.
Thank you. So let's talk about how can parents deal with their own anxiety now?
So that's a great question. I think, firstly, it is really important to be able to manage your own anxiety well, because your children are picking up on that. You know, there's a lot of talk about anxiety being genetic. And I think that before we jump to anxiety being genetic, we have to also just think about what it means to grow up seeing a parent handle situations from a place of anxiety. So there's a very strong component that is what we're seeing and how and what is being modeled to us and how to handle stressors. So we have an opportunity now where most people are pretty stressed out right now and pretty overwhelmed with what's going on in the world, and modeling to our children how we can feel emotions, talk about emotions, and manage emotions. So three different things: experience our feelings, communicate about our feelings, and manage our feelings. Showing that to our children is supremely valuable in them learning how to manage their own emotions and communicate appropriately.
So, like you said, it could be genetics. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Yeah. So there definitely seems to be consistent research demonstrating that anxiety has a genetic component. At the same time, I always like to acknowledge that that's very hard to parse apart from seeing our parents. You know, I always think of the example the parent sees a dog on the street, on the sidewalk, and crosses the street. That teaches the child that that dog is really dangerous. It does not teach the child that dogs are really, you know, 99% of the time, I don't know the statistics, but usually dogs are pretty safe. So it doesn't teach the child that. It teaches the child, no, we have to cross the street. Dogs are dangerous. So that can be valuable, a valuable opportunity to model more effective behavior. So now, during these more stressful times, you have an opportunity to, yes, experience stress. Like, don't not be experiencing it, and don't be pretending that you're not experiencing it, because all that teaches your child is that they shouldn't have emotions. And the fact that they have emotions is a bad thing, which is not true. Emotions are wonderful and they're there for a reason. So we want to show our child that we are having feelings. And you could say, you know, I sometimes I feel worried, or I heard a sound and I didn't know what it was, and I got worried for a second there. And you can talk about that, articulate how you feel feelings, but then also model yourself managing your feelings, like, oh, I got worried and then I checked and then I realized that everything's okay. Or I just, you know, I'm taking a couple breaths to calm myself down and then let's keep going. Or I'm reminding myself that everything's going to be okay. But talking out your process for experiencing and managing your emotions is really valuable for your children to see. That said, you have to actually have the skills to manage your own emotions. So if you're not having the skills to manage your own emotions, I definitely encourage people to get help to learn how to do that. But also, you can just take a few tips even of learning, you know, ways of soothing your body, ways of breathing, particularly focusing on longer out breaths that can just be pretty soothing. And these are just brief, you know, nothing miraculous or spectacular here, but these are just brief ways that you can calm yourself in a moment where the emotions are getting really intense that you can also share with your child. Another cute thing I like to share with parents is creating a crisis kit or a comfort basket, in like a shared space, so in like a living room, or if it's relevant for you, a bomb shelter, and creating a kit that has lots of things in it that can be really soothing, like squish balls or fidget spinners or bubbles, things that we want to encourage that these are things that you can use, that these are available to you, that they're it's not a big deal, that we can use things to help ourselves calm down, and we can do that for ourselves.
Thank you. So you say bomb shelters. Let's talk about why it's so important for people to get therapy, especially after a crisis.
Yeah, so there's mixed feelings about this, and I want to make myself clear on where I stand on this and why I stand clear on this. When we are faced with a crisis, most people will heal from that crisis. That doesn't mean just because we've experienced something that is a crisis or that's terribly, terribly, terribly a disaster or a crisis or a tragedy. And no one is denying that those things are really quite serious. That's not being denied. However, most people will recover naturally on their own from those situations, from their reaction to those situations, given some time within a couple months. What I mean by that is that it's actually normal in the immediate aftermath of a disaster or, you know, anything under that category, it's totally normal to have what we call an acute stress response or a response of, you know, everything that you would think is not healthy or not okay. Your body might be shaking. You might have a hard time sleeping or a hard time eating. You might throw up. You might feel sick to your stomach. You might think, I can't handle this. This is too much. You might be replaying the situation over and over in your mind. Those would all be normal, totally normal reactions, and nothing is wrong with those reactions. And what will happen with time, usually for most people, is that most people will have a chance to for their bodies to calm down and for their brains to register that the crisis is over, if the crisis is over, and also a chance to express what they experience so that they can kind of make sense or fit their experience into the world so that they can kind of balance themselves out and adjust to the world in which this big thing happened. And when we give people time, but also support and connection and care and opportunities to talk things out and opportunities to express themselves in different ways and ways to take care of themselves, then people heal with time. Most people will heal with time. What interrupts that process is if people are not able to express what's happening for them. So we do see that in the world, that people are expressing what's happening for them and their experience is being denied. That is happening today. And when that's happening, then that makes it much harder to process your experience because your experience is unspeakable. So we want to make room for and allow for people's experiences to be real and valid in the world and to be expressed. But yeah, so not allowing for real experiences to be expressed or or talked about can be really problematic, and avoiding going back to regular life. So I can't talk about this. I can't think about this. I can't do regular things. Or even I have to take a pill in order to manage. Those are all ways of not letting myself realize that the crisis is over and letting myself kind of heal and adjust back to regular life. So therefore, therapy is not usually the first thing I'd recommend in the aftermath of a crisis. I would much more recommend connecting people back to their basic resources like sleep, eat, move, drink water, you know, talk to people who you already know, get support, get attention, get time, and facilitating ways of expressing themselves. That is all really important. But therapy, providing an intervention beyond that, is often problematic because it doesn't necessarily facilitate that natural recovery we're looking for. So I wouldn't rush to therapy unless there's a specific reason. A time I would rush to therapy at this point is if there's a prior mental health history that hasn't been addressed or that hasn't been addressed well and now is like a little more explosive because of the situation, then I would move towards therapy. Or if the person is not capable of expressing themselves for whatever reason, perhaps a therapist could be helpful in facilitating that. Those are the times I would recommend it, but I'm not encouraging people to rush for trauma therapy because trauma therapy is really useful when a person doesn't recover. So we're talking about in 2 or 3 months from now, if somebody has not recovered, and that doesn't mean that they're okay, that they're okay or not okay. We're all not okay. And that is what it is. But if somebody has not recovered and they're still experiencing those symptoms, that's when I'd recommend getting trauma therapy. So I just be careful and mindful about that in terms of, you know, rushing and the urgency and the worry and concern.
Thank you for that clarity. So important for the listeners to hear. Dr. Kobinek, I enjoyed reading the books you put together for children. Let's tell my listeners all about them and what they as parents need to know on how to support their children.
Sure. Yeah. A couple weeks ago, I was talking with my children and I was hearing the questions that they were asking me about what's going on in their lives and in the world right now that they're facing. And I immediately felt like I just must get this down, both for them and for other children. So I created a book for young children who are living in a war, and I made it for young children and also created a little section on every page explaining to parents why the mother and child in the storybook are talking in that way, why the mother is saying that thing and why that's valuable. So it goes through guidelines for parents and it also gives, you know, some language around how to talk about things. So that was the first thing that I created, and it's been translated into Hebrew as well. Since then, I also created another book for children with a parent in the army, who might be missing their parent and not understanding fully, you know, what the significance is or why their parent is not home. So hopefully that gives some language around that and helps them feel more safe and more clear about what is going on. And then just recently created another book for older kids, kids more like 7 to 13, to articulate their experience and also give them more resources for how to calm themselves down in stressful times, that is kind of things that they can access on their own, that they don't feel like they need to get help with per se, but that they actually have a lot of resources already within them and they're so resilient and so strong and we're so proud of them, and helping just remind them and connect them to that. So those are the little books we put together. We put together some resources for parents as well. There's a little handbook on for adults on how to handle handle war times emotionally well. And there's also some material particularly geared for gap year students who are studying abroad this year, who might be struggling with issues related to suicide. So those are some guides for them and for their parents and teachers as well.
I'd like you to give out your website that people go and see your resources, please, that you're offering.
Yeah, so the website is the CBTDBTCenter.com/store. And all of our resources for current situations are currently free.
Wow, unbelievable resources available. You bring up two important topics. Let's talk about kids that may be abroad or family relatives that are abroad fighting in wars that, you know, in the war that we, you know, here we are in America or wherever you're listening to us. And those people that are in Israel have relatives around the world. So I'd like you to just give some language to somebody that would be speaking to somebody overseas, their loved ones, while they themselves are struggling with anxiety, please.
While they themselves are struggling with anxiety?
Yeah, so I'm the caller, or a mom or a dad is a caller speaking to their loved one in Israel, where, you know, whether they're in school or whether they're fighting in the army, and the person calling is struggling with their own anxiety, and you don't want that to go through the phone line where we're going to cause them more anxiety. So what would you suggest? A lot of parents have been calling for such information.
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, it's really important not to put the burden of responsibility for your emotional needs on somebody else who's going through a hard time. So if your loved one is in Israel, putting your own, and you are feeling stressed, you don't want to put that on them. That's kind of not fair to them. So what you can do is try and before you get on the phone or the call or the video, whatever it is, try and kind of own where you are and then find a way to put all of that stuff that's inside of you right now in a little box, in a little shelf, in a little bowl, somewhere else, so that you can make space to be there for this person. And I think that's really important to understand, is that you can put your own feelings on the side so that you can be there fully for the person that you're with. I do this all the time as a therapist. I have my own feelings and my own, thoughts and things that are hard for me. But when I'm coming in to be with a client, I'm making space for just them. So I'm putting all of that on the side and I'm just stepping in to be for them. So that can be helpful. I think also remembering that, you know, really listen to your loved one. What is their day-to-day like? Are they actually in danger or not? Because when you're far away, what you see on the news is always scarier. I would say it's always hard, not harder, but in a way, there's a massive challenge in not being the one going through the thing. Because when you're going through the thing, you know what the thing is. But when you're not, you have to just kind of watch and sit in that not knowing. So that can be really, really hard. But try and ask yourself, is this person really safe? And you can ask questions to help understand, what is the situation? What's the situation today? What's telling you that you're safe today? So that getting that kind of information can be helpful in getting a more honest picture. I think those are the really important things, is grounding in facts and putting yourself on the side so that you can be there for this person.
Now, you brought up suicide. People worry that they, you know, some people, they have their own suicidal thoughts. Let's discuss how DBT can be helpful with that.
Sure. So DBT is an excellent treatment for working with suicide. And remember, I said earlier that DBT is a treatment for emotion dysregulation. So if we can think of suicide as often, obviously there's, you know, different people are different, but suicide is often a long-term solution to a short-term problem. The short-term problem is emotional pain, and the long-term solution is suicide. And it's not a very good solution because we don't know that it actually solves anything. And it's also permanent. So it's not a very good solution, but it is a way that people often kind of mentally come up with this way of escaping the amount of pain they're in. So it's actually very common for somebody who's feeling difficult things to think, I don't want to experience this anymore. I want this pain to stop. So that's very logical and normal. And at the same time, we want to deal with it. I want to differentiate between passive versus active suicidality. Passive suicidality is where that I was just describing before. I don't want to exist. I don't want to feel this. This is really painful. Versus active suicidality is I actually plan to go through with this. I have a way of doing this that I'm going to go through with. That's really different. So there's not, I don't necessarily get excited if somebody doesn't want to be feeling the pain they're in, because that's perfectly normal. And I want to deal with that. The way that DBT addresses this is I cannot fully capture, because like I said, this treatment is complex. But first of all, very often people who are experiencing their emotions in a big way come to session with another crisis every week. And so it comes really hard to actually move with to move with anything. And so DBT really tries to structure the sessions so that sessions are highly, highly focused on the most important targets. So suicide is always considered the highest target. Secondly, we show up in the moment when the person is having the urge before they've done anything so that we can help form new behaviors and new ways of responding. And we teach lots of ways of managing high levels of emotional distress without making our lives worse. We also then teach people how to recognize when their emotions are escalating so we don't have to wait till we hit hundreds, and how to navigate when you hit 50, 60, 70. So it doesn't have to always be so intense. So that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you. I have one last quick question. So if a child fears with their parent that they have suicide thoughts, what would be the first response a mom or dad should say to their loved one?
I'm so glad you told me. We're going to figure this out together. That would be the first response. I'm so glad you told me. We're going to figure this out together. The second response should be validating that, of course, if they're in emotional pain, it makes sense that they're responding that way. So we want to start with, I'm so glad you told me. We'll figure this out together. It makes so much sense when you're in so much pain that this is what your mind's been going to. And we're going to get you help. I would just be careful how you phrase, we're going to get you a therapist. That definitely you want that to be part of the conversation, but not coming from a, you're sick, you need help because there's something wrong with you, but more, we're going to get help. We're going to figure this out. We're going to deal with this together kind of an idea.
Thank you. Thank you really very, very much for all this important information. And again, please let's give out your website, free resources. Go on to the website.
Sure. It's COVID. The CBTDBTCenter.com/store.
Thank you. I hope to have you on again soon. Stay safe, stay healthy. Thank you for coming on. I want to wish everyone a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos, and always remember, hang in, hold on, and virtually for now still hug tight. Tonight's show is in honor of all the Chayalim. Please consider to donate online to maskparents.org so we could continue with all our programs. Thank you and have a good night.
This is Zev Brenner inviting you to join me as I emcee a unity concert, Solidarity with Israel, a night of song, prayer, and solidarity with Israel on the occasion of the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach of blessed memory, featuring Yehuda Green, Joey Newcomb, Shirley Williger, accompanied by Chroma. All takes place this Moitzoy Shabbos, October 28th, at the Westside Institutional Synagogue, 120 West 76th Street in Manhattan. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. with Abdullah by Chaim Kiss at 9 p.m. Tickets are $50. VIP seating available at $125. Student pricing available for those under 25. It's only $25 with valid ID. For information and to reserve, and please come, visit thekalbachshul.org. All profits will go to United Hatzalah, sponsored by Joy Fishman in memory of her son Jonathan Stampler. So please join us for Unity Concert in solidarity with Israel this Moitzoy Shabbos.
You are listening to
Talkline Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.